Faith and Force, Questions and Answers.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rand, for that very inspiring and interesting talk. Now, as previously planned, she will be open for a question and answer period. If there's any discussion, any questions that you would like to ask Ms. Rand? Lady right here, please.
Well, to follow your own example, read The Fountainhead. Because that is a story in which the character deals with society as it is today. And also, of course, question your definitions. You cannot say that when a character dies, this is an ideal solution. The ideal solution, using your expression, in We the Living, is merely to show that the better kind of people, the people of any integrity or independence, cannot survive under a statist dictatorship and necessarily have to perish, either spiritually or physically. That is why the characters in We the Living had to die, if my theme there was to show the essence of a dictatorship. Anyone who escapes from a dictatorship is an exception. In the nature of a dictatorship, the extent to which men have any values of character is the extent to which they are doomed and are slated for eventual destruction. Now, that's the theme of We the Living. In Atlas Shrugged, I showed you the practical way of dealing with collectivism, only never take things literally when they are inapplicable, or rather take them literally only when they apply literally. What do I mean by that? Well, in Atlas Shrugged, I show that men go on strike. The men of intelligence and ability go on strike against collectivist slavery. And the world left without mind perishes. And then the men of the mind, the men of intelligence and self-esteem, are free to start rebuilding the world. Now, the state in which we exist today, or the state of collectivism we have reached, is not yet as bad as the one I present in Atlas Shrugged. I intended Atlas Shrugged, in effect, to present the society of about 10 years ahead of the time at which you read the book. It's just the immediate future, or the next consistent step, if the trends of the present are to be continued. But there is no historical determinism, and these trends do not have to be continued. So long as we have not yet reached the state of censorship of ideas, one does not have to leave a society in the way the characters did in Atlas Shrugged. One does not have to yet break relationship to the society. But you know what one has to do? One has to break relationships with the culture. Meaning, while you live in this society, break all cultural relationships. Meaning, withdraw your sanction from those people's groups, schools, or theories which preach the ideas that are destroying you. If you read Atlas Shrugged, you will understand what I mean by the situation of the sanction of the victim. It's the situation in which the good people are helping their own destroyers, and I show in how many ways men are guilty of that, through generosity or ignorance. Men are supporting their own destroyers materially and spiritually, in their private lives and in their public lives. Now, what we have to do today, anyone who is serious about saving the world, would have to first discard all the kind of ideas, the entire cultural philosophy which is dominant today. Do not accept any of their ideas. Stand on your own as much as if you had to go into a separate valley, like in Atlas Shrugged. Stand on your own mind. Check your premises. Define your conviction. Define them rationally. Do not take anyone on faith, and do not believe that your elders know what they're doing, because they don't. You have to be the responsible creators of a new culture, if there is to be any culture. That is the sense in which Atlas Shrugged is applicable to our period. We are not yet totally collectivized. We have a chance. More than that, the enemy ideologists today, I mean all collectivism and altruism, are so bankrupt that nothing holds them up except inertia and default. People are still mouthing their slogans because that is all they know. The innovators or initiators in the realm of ideas are very rare, most particularly moral ideals. You may observe in the history of philosophy that all ideas changed in various periods, but morality is the one realm that did not change. Only its superficial forms changed. Men have always been taught that they have to live for others and they have to be sacrificial animals. Or that the opposite would be some kind of brute dog-eat-dog situation in which every man destroys or sacrifices every other man. And in practice, you see that this dog-eat-dog idea is applicable to socialism and collectivism, but never to a free society. In other words, morality is the one issue which men are afraid to challenge, and that is what you have to challenge today. Break with the morality of altruism. Don't be afraid to assert your right to exist, but don't assert it as an arbitrary whim. You would have to know how to justify it rationally and philosophically and why you have that right and why, if men practiced a rational morality of self-interest, their interests would not clash. Men then would not have to sacrifice one another so long as nobody demands or expects or gives the unearned and undeserved. If no man regards others as potentially sacrificial material for himself or for his idea of what would be good for a third party. When man drops all those ramifications of altruism, then you will see what a benevolent, ideal society one could have, and America almost had it. The world came near to it at the end of the 19th century. If you read some of the popular literature of that period, you won't believe it. You will think that this is somebody's fiction, only it isn't. It's the naturalistic or realistic stories of that period. I refer specifically to magazine and popular fiction, which is a very good index of the general view of life and sense of life of a culture. You do not even know what a magnificent world America had. Now it isn't fully gone, and it's in your power to build it again. But the retirement to which you have to go is cultural. Break with altruism and with every idea that is based on it. At least make the effort to think it out very carefully. You'll be surprised how easy that revolution will be and how difficult it appears now, but it isn't. Just give it one day's thought and you have a different view. Now, I don't mean that that's all it will take. I mean, just give that to consider whether it's possible, after which you'll have to do harder thinking than you ever attempted before, because you'd have to be totally on your own, totally relying on your own judgment and the logic of the arguments you hear or consider, rejecting all authorities, rejecting all bromides, and taking nothing on faith. But if you try it, you'll be surprised how close the Renaissance is to us, and it's up to each human being to work for it. Next.
May I remind you or point out to you that Miss Rand's books are available in paperback form at all the bookstores. Gentleman down here in the third row, please.
Yes.
Could you explain why you had Donna Mead after she did it in the garden, particularly why she married Kitty
Feeney? Would you say that again? Why did Dominique what?
Yes, why did Dominique, or why did you have Dominique after Miss Rand as she did? Particularly, why did she marry Kitty Feeney?
I see. The question is, in the Fountainhead, why did I have Dominique act as she did against Rourke, particularly, why did she marry Peter Keating? Well, I did explain it in the Fountainhead through Dominique's own words, but I can elaborate it a little. Dominique's error is the error from which very many good people suffer, only not quite in so extreme a form. She was so devoted to values. She was an independent individualist. She had a very clear view of what she considered the ideal, only she didn't think that the ideal is possible. Her error is what philosophically I call the malevolent universe premise. namely the belief that the good has no chance on earth, that the good is doomed to lose, and that evil is metaphysically powerful. In other words, in reality, the evil succeeds and the good is doomed to perish. Now, many people make that mistake, and the reason for that mistake is that they form their conclusions by statistical impressions. That is, as you grow up, if you look around you, you will certainly see more evil than virtue. You will be disappointed more often than pleased. You will be hurt very often. You will see a lot of injustice. And with each generation, on the present cultural premise, it's getting worse and worse. Now, it's by emotional overgeneralization from these first impressions that a great many people whose basic premises are good decide to become, in effect, philosophical subjectivists. They think that their values can never be shared by others, nor can be communicated to others, and therefore can never win in practical reality. That was Dominique's mistake. Therefore, she acted against Rourke because she was convinced that he should retire and never open himself up to the world to be heard, that he should not attempt to fight the world because he was too good to win. That was, in effect, her attitude. So that, observe, her actions against Rourke were really superficial. She did not create any major damage to him, and she never would. But her actions implied an enormous compliment to him. They implied her enormous understanding and valuing of him as a great man and a great creative talent, and it was the misdirected application of her estimate, the nature of the world, that caused her to do what she did. Why did she marry Peter Keating? Because he was the least worthy of it. It was her symbol of rebellion in this way. She never made the mistake of deciding that she, since the world is evil, she will make terms with the evil and will try to be happy on the terms of others, like Keating decided and like Winant decided. No, she was too good for that. She would not seek happiness in a world which she considered evil. So she married a man whom she could not love or respect as a symbol of her defiance, of the desire not to seek anything in a world as low as she thought it was. Well, she learned better. At the end of the book, she discovered why she had been wrong and why Rourke was right. Now, Rourke would not attempt to stop her. He was right when he concluded that she has to correct her own error herself. She has to be convinced of her error, or they could never be happy together. And if you translate this abstraction in less extreme forms, I venture to say that most of you, because it's true of most men, share Dominique's error in some form or another. You may not necessarily try to stop the careers of the man or woman you love, but any time that you have a good idea or a value which you hold as very important to you, you will tend to repress it. You will tend to feel, this is good and I know it, but nobody else will understand me, nobody else will share it. Why be hurt? Well, any time you experience an emotion of that kind, you're acting on Dominique's error, and you better correct it. Next question.
Gentlemen, right there, please.
How does the philosophy of objectivism apply to minor social problems, such as the problem of the underprivileged and underdeveloped Negroes in, say, Africa?
The question is, how does the philosophy of objectivism apply to the underdeveloped nations, such as the Negroes in Africa or the American South? Well, observe, the American South is the one part of the country that had never been capitalist. The South was an agrarian society and, in fact, more feudal. Feudalism of the Middle Ages rather than industrial capitalism, which is why the South held on to slavery. Now, objectivism stands for capitalism, and capitalism is the one system that is incompatible with slavery. In fact, capitalism did wipe out slavery in the 19th century, including the American Civil War and even Russian serfdom. Capitalism cannot function with slave labor, and the moral principles implicit in capitalism do not permit slavery. Therefore, the first thing that objectivism would hold in regard to underdeveloped nation is that the only way in which we can help them to develop is not by giving them material help, not by sending free teachers down there, but by teaching them freedom, political freedom, only that. Any nation, no matter how low a development, if they establish a political system which protects the right of the individuals, the progress and development of that nation will be phenomenal. Then the best in all men works to raise that society and to contribute to the progress of all, but not by selfless sacrifice, by plain intelligent self-interest, because capitalism, as you can observe in history, raises the general standard of living. And men on all levels of ability are rewarded and get much more than they could get under any form of statism or tribal rule. Now, if you wanted to help the situation in Africa, the one chance they have, the only thing one can do for them, is teach them the theory of freedom. If people who have lived for centuries in violence would discover that they have a chance to exercise their ingenuity to create something, and that their rulers will protect them rather than forbid it or expropriate it, you will be amazed what productive talent suddenly will rise. Observe that at the start of the Industrial Revolution, most nations in the world were pretty primitive, perhaps not as far back as the African people, but still, they were savages in the Middle Ages compared to what they are today. And then one century of freedom under government protection, that is a government which protected men from violence, protected their individual rights and their individual property. After one century, you can't recognize the nature of the civilization, of the material prosperity, and undreamed of talents suddenly appear among men. Well, I would predict the same thing would happen in Africa. If there were anybody to teach them what is freedom and what is capitalism, unfortunately, that's not what we are exporting today. That's not what we are teaching them. And all we are doing is that we will arm them without giving them the kind of ideology that should go with those arms, the ideology of freedom and human rights, and will only help them to destroy each other in civil wars, same as all the other more civilized nations of the earth are now doing. They're all destroying each other by violence. So that the only thing one could do for the underprivileged is, of course, that which created privilege for any human being, freedom and protection of your rights. As to the present situation in the South, freedom, capitalism, and rational education is what will solve it, not violence, as they're doing it now. If you want my opinion of the Southern situation, the real evils there are the state laws which enforce segregation by law, but the solution of it is not enforced integration by federal law, because it's two forces fighting each other, both immoral. What should be done? I don't know how quickly one could ever persuade people to that, but what I would advocate is the repeal of any law which attempts to legislate moral issues or which penalizes men or discriminates against men on any ground whatever, racial, ideological, religious, or any other. The real evil in the South started with their state laws, but then the federal government imposing federal force on it will only create more mutual hatred, more underground hypocrisy. If you really want to solve the problem, set men free. In every free country, prejudice vanishes automatically, and such prejudice as might remains only among the lunatic fringe or the kind of people who properly would be afraid to admit it openly, and if so, who cares to associate with them? Leave them to heaven if that's what they want. That is, any fanatics or prejudiced bigots or racists in a free society. But when they have government power behind them and when they enforce their prejudice, one way or the other, when they enforce segregation or integration by force all that you will get is more race prejudice, and every racial group of all differ, not only white against Negro, but every racial stock will then draw closer together, because collectivism drives men into racism. Racism is the most primitive form of collectivism, the easiest, because it's the almost animal kind, the automatic, to be drawn to a collective by birth, not even of your choice, but simply of accidents. The easiest collectivism for men to draw into, and today's ideas are pushing them into it. Now remember that the smallest minority on earth is the individual. And if you do not protect individual rights, you will not be able to protect minority rights. And if you don't protect those, then of course the majority will have no rights either. Because a minority or a majority is only composed of individuals. If you don't stand for individual rights, you will have no rights of any other kind, and you have the whole of history to show you how a majority that infringes individual rights perishes also. Who's next?
Gentleman in the back there, please.
Have I understood what you were telling us? You were implying, at least, that the physical violence of totalitarian governments and of thugs is the result of altruism. If a national government is physically stronger than a subject people, or a successful thug is physically stronger than a weaker victim, may not reason and self-interest rather than altruism lead such governments and thugs to physical violence?
Let me repeat the question. It's fairly long. Correct me if I didn't get it right. You say that I said that the morality of altruism leads individual thugs and governments to resort to physical violence. And your question is, if an individual thug is stronger than other men, or national government is stronger than other people, did you say, would reason make them resort to violence?
Yeah.
Is that the way you stated?
Now,
to begin with, reason consists of knowing the nature and the consequences of your own actions and of knowing where your rational self-interest lies. Reason does not mean that anyone can arbitrarily decide by whim whichever it is that he wants is to his own self-interest. That men certainly do it, but that is not rational. To go by reason means that you do not see your self-interest in whichever you may desire. You are not guided by emotions or whims. You have rational, moral, philosophical reasons for your desires and the goals you try to achieve. First, as a preamble. Now, the first issue that reason would demand of you is the recognition of human rights. Why? Well, I briefly indicated it in what I have read to you of the basis of the morality of objectivism, which is the first system of rational morality. That is a morality not based on any whim, categorical imperative, or revelation. It's based on a very simple fact. Man has to exist by means of his mind. It wouldn't take a long process of reason to observe that anything which you may want or need has to be produced, and that man has to possess knowledge in order to produce it, and that reason provides that knowledge. Once you know that, then if you decide that you don't want to exist by means of production, since you're physically strong, you prefer to rob or enslave somebody else. If you then decide that you will live not by means of reason, but by means of your muscle, you are contradicting the only base on which you could have any justification for your existence. You are guilty then of the most fundamentally irrational contradiction. The only ground on which you can claim the right to your own life is the same ground that you have to grant to the entire human species. If you claim an exception, if you claim a double standard, you cannot defend it in reason. If you want to be rational, then you have to realize that the only ground on which you could justify your right to your own life is the fact that man has to exist by means of his reason, that his life is in his own hands and he has to serve his own interests. but that same consideration applies to every human being. You could not claim it philosophically and rationally for yourself if you do not grant it to others. And therefore, to say, I know that men exist by reason, but I am going to use a club instead, is not going to be valid rationally. More than that, a man of self-esteem, a man who uses his reason, does not want the unearned. He does not want anything from others which he has to obtain by means of force or coercion, by individual crime or by government force and regulation. A man of reason and self-esteem does not want the unearned. He deals with men as an equal by trade. His reason will tell him why. More than that, a man of reason plans his life long range. It is the particular distinction, if you want a psychological easy diagnosis, the particular distinction of a rational man from an evader is that a rational man thinks, plans, and acts long range, while the more neurotic and evasive a person, the shorter the range of his interests. The playboy or the drunkard, the kind of pleasure chaser that is unable to look beyond the range of the immediate moment, is a very irrational, miserable neurotic. A rational person lives long range. Now, no rational person is going to decide that it's to his self-interest to rob and murder others and resort to force because he knows too well that others will answer him and should answer him by the same means. No rational person ever starts wars. More than that, this is so in theory, but now read actual history. Who started wars? Who led America into World War I? Woodrow Wilson, a humanitarian reformer. He did not do it for any selfish greed reasons. You know the stories which you might have heard about the selfish greed of capitalists leading people to war countries, but it just isn't so historically. Woodrow Wilson led America into World War I because he thought it was a crusade to save the world, make the world safe for democracy, to spread freedom through the world. What did Franklin D. Roosevelt do in World War II? He pushed his country into war to save the world and bring them the four freedoms, if any of you might remember the slogan. And observe, in both cases, the state of the world after those wars was infinitely worse than it was before, and precisely the respects that those two particular humanitarians wanted to correct. In both cases, the world became more enslaved, with a greater spread of dictatorships, poverty, and misery. But more important than all, in the whole of history, you will never find a dictatorship from the Egyptian pharaohs on up to Mr. Kennedy, who is not a dictator yet. But if he isn't one, it will be up to you to see that he isn't one. There has never been a dictator or potential dictator who has ever justified dictatorships on the ground of selfishness or individual rights. It is only on the ground of the altruist morality that a dictator can get away with it. He always has to offer his victims some kind of goal and tell them to sacrifice their personal interest to it. And the reason why I mention Mr. Kennedy is because I'm very concerned. It is a very dangerous sign when a presidential candidate tells you he's going to demand sacrifice of you without even telling you for what. Where sacrifice has become an end in itself. It's just morally good to sacrifice and don't ask why and to whom. Take a look at Hitler. If any of you have read Mein Kampf or any of the Nazi publications, which are available in history books, you will be surprised to what extent they utter altruistic slogans that are indistinguishable from the communist slogans. They despise individualism and the bourgeois selfishness, as they call it. What do they ask of the German people? Service to the state and the country, self-sacrifice, the merging of your interests in the great national racial whole, etc. There has never been a dictatorship that did not use altruistic slogans and the altruist morality to make men sacrifice themselves or bear self-sacrifice. There never has been in history, there never can be in theory. But what a man tells you, you have the right to live for your own sake, but you have no right to sacrifice anybody else, you may be sure that what he is telling you has no vested interest in it on which any dictator could make a stand. No dictator could last or even come in by telling you that you have a right to your own life and that he has no right to force you. Just try to project as a science fiction, as an exercise, how a dictator could attempt to come to power and then to rule without the use of the altruist morality, and you'll see that it's impossible. On the other hand, the Declaration of Independence was actually the document that by implication did contain my morality, the objectivist morality, but only by implication. What did it say? Man has a right to his own life, his own happiness, his own liberty, and the pursuit of his own happiness, not service to others. And observe what kind of magnificent and benevolent society was the result. That really should be enough to convince you.
Mr. Veitch, please.
You've spoken, and if we accept the rational epistemological criterion rather than the metaphysical, the one of mysticism, how do you justify the value placed in survival and individual freedom? And then how do you go beyond this to justify the use of reason as its own epistemological criterion or justification?
I'm not sure I understand the question. How do I justify freedom and how do I justify reason as its own epistemological?
How can you prove by reason that reason is the epistemological criterion that we should be using?
You know, that's interesting. I should ask you that question. I assume that you are opposed to this viewpoint. How can I use reason to prove that reason is valid? Well, the word proof is a concept that is based on and derived from the field of reason. It does not exist outside of it. If you read Gold's speech, now I have said I cannot discuss epistemology in detail here. So I will refer you to Gold's speech, but I will indicate my answer briefly. You have to first define what is reason. And reason rests necessarily on the self-evident proof of your senses, that which you perceive, not your sense data, not your sensations, but your percepts, which is sense data integrated by your mind or your brain automatically. That is the start of human knowledge. That has to be taken as the self-evident because that is the content of your consciousness, and you cannot talk about consciousness without identifying the fact that your consciousness starts with the perception of objects and entities of the material world outside of you. Then you have to know what reason is. And reason is an issue of forming abstractions by means of specific and absolute definitions, abstracting from your perceptual material that which you observe certain entities to possess in common or that which differentiate certain entities, and you form abstractions. Now, when you come to the concept of proof, it is a concept which hierarchically is based on and depends on the concept of reason, axioms, and evidence. To prove something is to lead it by means of logic down to a fundamental axiom. For details of that, see Aristotle and see also my works. But now to speak of proving reason or of proving the laws of logic is a conceptual contradiction in terms. Reason and logic is that by means of which you prove something. It in itself is the primary or the base. You do not prove the laws of logic. They are implicit in your first sensation. The law of identity is perceived by you the first time you perceive the blob of light, but it takes a great deal of perceptual and conceptual knowledge to get you to, let us say, the age of 12 or 15, by which time you can understand or identify the law of identity in conscious conceptual terms. But implicitly, it was there long before that time. It's there with your first sensation. Now, this is a very brief condensation. And if you are interested in the subject, you know that one cannot answer it in a question period, not exhaustively. So I can only give you an indication of what my answer is.
Question here on the aisle.
Thus, in your mind, enunciates capitalism today. And could you comment on the form of capitalism advocated by Kelso and Adler in the Capitalist Manifesto?
I missed the first part of your question. What did you say?
Who best, in your mind, enunciates capitalism today?
Oh, the question is who best enunciates capitalism today, and then you want me to comment on the Kelso and Adler Capitalist Manifesto. Well, to answer you on the last first, that book is anything but a manifesto or pro-capitalist. It is a real collectivist document which is based on the idea that a government can do anything and that you're going to force competition on people by force. Those others have a new book since then and continue the same idea. In effect, they think that capitalism is government controls for a certain purpose, such as competition. This is only giving credence to a very widespread error that capitalism is a system in which government exercises certain controls, but for the advantages of the rich or the employers. And therefore, the welfare state then is government controls for the advantages of the poor or the employees. Well, that's a false dichotomy. Pure capitalism is laissez-faire capitalism. It means no government control, no interference into the economy, into production and trade, neither on the side of management or labor or the rich or the poor. Now, the Adler-Kelso theories, government controls to force on people their particular unworkable version of contradictions. That's not capitalism. Now, if you want to say, me to recommend what authors I would consider the best expositors of capitalism today, the first book I would recommend is Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. I will repeat it for those of you who may want to get it. Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt, Hazlitt. Now, this is the best book as an introduction to the basic principles of free enterprise or capitalist economics. It's very easy reading. It's not popularized, but a very well-written, very clear primer for beginners in economics, but on a high intellectual level, and it'll give you a very good working knowledge of what a capitalist system is. The next book I would recommend would be Omnipotent Government by Ludwig von Mises, Mises. Generally, Ludwig von Mises today is the best economist, the most consistent, and the most erudite. He is the arch economist, the dean of all the economists of capitalism. He has written a great many books. Some of them are much too technical for beginners, but as any one author, I would say Ludwig von Mises is the best of the pro-capitalist economists. Now, I want to stress only one point. I do not agree with any authors I will name now, neither Mr. Hazlitt nor von Mises, in many other respects, for instance, about epistemology or morality. Both of them are more or less on the Benthamite or utilitarian school of social morality, but this isn't the issue here. As economists, I do agree because they prove their case and you can judge them strictly on the ground of their economics. If you want an idea on how capitalism works, I would say first, Economics in One Lesson as an introduction, then read Omnipotent Government by von Mises, which is a work showing how the intellectuals of Europe, he takes particularly Germany as the example, led to the totalitarian state, by what steps they led Germany to Hitlerism, and he gives you dates and places. He gives you a complete documented record, which is an excellent book to show how ideas destroy a culture. Next, I would recommend another book by Ludwig von Mises called Socialism. It's a refutation of every single claim and every single attempt at the socialist economy ever proposed or tried by anyone. It is like a kind of an omnibus of all socialist fallacies, very brilliantly and rationally exploded. It's Socialism by Ludwig von Mises. There's another very interesting book I would recommend, but it's out of print today. That's Capitalism, the Creator by Carl Schneider. I believe he's dead now, so it's not a current author, but it was published some 20 years ago. It's an excellent book, again, to give you at least a working understanding of the economics of capitalism. And as a warning, I would suggest that you stay away from authors like Kelso and Adler if your purpose is to discover what capitalism is. Those are middle-of-the-road modern intellectuals. Above all, I would not recommend Hayek, who is very often mentioned and is probably one of the more widely known economists who is allegedly for capitalism, but he's not. He's actually middle of the road. He is for a mixed economy and therefore a great favorite among the liberals. He's a liberal capitalist, if you know what that means, and that is a contradiction in terms, and you'll get nothing but pretty difficult confusions out of his books. Therefore, if you read him very critically, but I would not recommend him, certainly not as a guide to capitalism. I think those should be enough.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Rand.
Don't we have time for one more? I didn't mean enough for the question. I mean enough for the reading.
I want to, I know there are a number of questions, Ms. Rand, and I don't suppose you'll be able to answer them all. Please continue as long as you
no,
feel.
No, we have just about, we're not an hour
it's 20,
yet.
It's 20 after 4, so you can continue.
How long have we been going?
We started at 2:30. You can continue as long as
no,
you
No, no, I mean the question period.
We started at about 4, or a quarter of 4, I think.
Oh, we have, I think we have time for at least 2 more questions.
Yes, all right.
This young man here.
This young man here, all right.
Under objectivism, what do you believe your social responsibility towards other people consists?
A question is, under objectivism, what would be your social responsibility toward other people? Only one, rationality, and hands off. If you want the briefest formulation. Meaning you are not your brother's keeper, you cannot and do not have unchosen obligations, but you are responsible for your own action. You would be responsible for any harm that you do to other people. You will be responsible for any relationship which you undertake voluntarily to enter into, for any contract which you cannot break unilaterally. You would have to stand by your word, and you would have to bear the responsibility for any action which you initiate. You would have no right to pass on the burden of your mistakes or failures or you changing your mind onto others who may suffer from it. In other words, you cannot make other men your victims, and you do not have to be their victim. That is all. Now, any help that you may want to give others would be strictly your private privilege, but not your moral and certainly not your legal and political duty. If you want to help others, fine, so long as you can afford it, so long as it's your voluntary choice, and so long as you do not claim it as a major virtue or moral duty. And properly speaking, it is good to help others only when you help them on the ground of the value you see in them. If you see a talented man struggling and you want to help him financially, if you can afford it and it's not a sacrifice, that would be a good gesture under my morality. But it is not a good gesture to help a man who is suffering for his volitional evil. If you see a man who is in need or in trouble through his own moral fault, then you are only sanctioning and helping his immorality if you help him. Therefore, it is evil ever to help those who are in trouble or who suffer through their own fault. In such cases, it is evil to help them. That, in brief, would be the social relationships. I think this young man here was crying for a long time.
What I'd like to know is, what would you say is the rational long-run self-interest of a capitalist, and by a capitalist I mean here, someone who has by his own previous wealth ensured his political freedom, his material well-being, and so on and so forth. Say he's presented with a situation in which he's fighting other large corporations. Now, what would be his rational self-interest here?
I don't quite get the question. Let me repeat it. You say, what would be the self-interest of a man under capitalism?
A capitalist.
What do you mean by a capitalist? A man who is rich and who, let us say, owns a corporation of a certain kind, and he has to fight other corporations.
For the life of his corporation.
Well, what do you mean by that? Well, what would be to his self-interest?
Yes. Is he the corporation?
Now, you're talking about a free society and a free economy.
Yes.
On a free economy, there's only one thing that determines the life of a corporation or any other profession: competition on the free market. If a man has a corporation and they are doing producing a good product and people are willing to buy it, that is what makes them continue and prosper. Now suppose other corporations come on the market and they are putting out a better product or the same product cheaper, then nothing can save the life of that first corporation. If it cannot improve and meet that competition, it has to go out of existence, which is only justice, because why should anybody have to pay for a less competent product? Why should you penalize the public? Here you would make the public the victims if you said that this man, the first one, with this corporation which is now failing, is entitled to hold his corporation when he is unable to meet an abler competitor. Now, in a free economy, he would have no way to save his corporation except by devising a still better product and holding his own with the customers. That is the way it actually functions. This is not theory. Now, he would have no way to resort to law. The one thing he couldn't do is by, in any sense, go to the government and demand any special privilege which will tie up his competitors or give him a monopoly on his particular territory. Monopolies, incidentally, are always created by an act of government and maintained by an act of government, which gives a special franchise, privilege, or subsidy to some corporation or individual and bars others from that field. Now, do you want to debate or to ask another question?
Well, I must admit that I do disagree with you on a certain point.
Put it in the form of a question, then.
Well, all right. I'd like to clarify the question. What I mean is, it seems to me that under your philosophy of objectivism, there would be no reason for a capitalist who would ensure what I seem to conceive that you think are a self-interest, personal survival, political freedom, material well-being, and so on and so forth. If he had these insured, aside from the position of his corporation, there would be no reason for him to continue to improve his product or to do anything of this sort. I don't see how rational self-interest applies.
The question is, may I condense it? The question is that you do not see why under capitalism, if a man once established his position and got wealthy and had a good company and his freedom, there would be no incentive for him to improve his product.
Well,
that would not be to his rational self-interest.
Yes.
Is this what you said?
I'm saying that his wealth is insured aside from the life of his corporation.
You mean that then once he has made his pile, so to speak, there's no reason for him to improve his product? No. Now, let's differentiate 2 points. Point number one is that economically, I think I answered in my preceding answer, that is, he would have to, if he wants to continue on the market, he would have to improve his product or go bankrupt or quit and close. Therefore, economically, you see, if he wants to remain in business, a free system will force him for his free interest, by force I mean metaphorically now, would force him to continue producing better and better. But now under my morality, well, it's a very good question. Now look, take terms literally. When I say that a man survives by means of his mind, when I say that a man's first moral virtue is to think and to be productive, it isn't the same as saying get your pile by hook or crook and then sit at home and enjoy your money, even if it were possible. Incidentally, in a free economy, it won't last very long. If you don't invest your fortune productively, if you don't have the judgment for that, you will still be wiped out, but maybe you'll last your lifetime if you're very rich. Well, now look, what I'm telling you is that your first moral duty is to think. Not duty, I don't like the word, virtue, because duty implies the arbitrary. If your basic virtue is to be productive, to use your mind as to think, what would that alleged millionaire do after he retires? Do you assume that it's to a man's self-interest, rationally, to just ensure his physical luxury? Well, what would he do with himself when he has those millions? He would have to stagnate. No man who has used his mind enough to achieve a fortune is going to be happy doing nothing. His self-interest does not lie in consumption. The self-interest of a rational man lies in production, in the creative expansion of his mind. If you want me to take it deeper than that, observe, in order to exist, every part of your body, every part of your organism has to function. If it doesn't, it atrophies. Well, it applies to a man's mind more than to any other faculty. In order to actually be alive properly, and therefore under my morality, this is why it's the basic virtue, a man has to use his mind constantly and productively. Every achievement is only an incentive for the next achievement. What does he want from that? The creative happiness of achieving greater and greater control over reality, greater and more ambitious values in whichever line of endeavor he's using his mind, whether as an industrialist, scientist, artist, or in any activity. For a man to decide, I am now have enough so I don't have to think, is would be the same thing as to decide, why should I use my legs now? I'm rich, I will go around in a wheelchair. That would not be to his physical self-interest. Well, it's even less conceivable and less rationally justifiable for a man to decide that it's in his self-interest not to use his mind. You see, the idea of survival, perhaps you might have misunderstood me on this point, is not merely that you have to think in order to survive physically for this moment. In order to survive properly, man has to think constantly. There never is a day when he can say, well, now I've thought enough. Man cannot survive automatically. The day when he decides that he does not need to be creative anymore, he is dead spiritually and old. Only I've never known of a case in psychology, incredible, of any productive man who would decide to retire because he's now rich. The truly productive men don't. They work and die at their desk. The only ones that do sometimes, particularly in recent times, are the ones who give up in discouragement because the social system destroys them, not otherwise. We can't have more arguments.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rann. We certainly appreciate your coming and speaking to us.
Thank you.
For additional information about other available programs, please contact Second Renaissance at 1-800-729-6149 or at www.ayanrandbookstore.com. All material in this program is protected by copyright and may not be reproduced in any form or manner, nor played before an audience, without the express written permission of the producer, Second Renaissance Incorporated.